Good afternoon. First, I want to thank the two organizers for inviting me here. So the goal of this talk is to present a unified picture of chaos, scrambling, and computational complexity using the information theoretic framework of unitary quantum channels. And this is motivated primarily by puzzles in black hole physics and holography, specifically with respect to how black holes process quantum information, and or more geometrically, how to think about their interior. The story starts with the butterfly effect. You all know what it is. As you can see, a tornado forms in Kansas, and then sometime later, due to chaotic dynamics, a butterfly materializes on the other side of the world, in Beijing. Apologies, that's not quite right. You know, cartoons are always a little misleading. Let's just state the problem directly. In quantum systems, the question becomes, can a small perturbation W have a macroscopic effect on the system? Does the information about a small perturbation W stay localized under time evolution? And when does the state start to become generic again? And really, our objective is to be doctors. We're going to diagnose a lot of things. And along with diagnosing, you have to give definitions. And so I will explain what I mean by chaos, scrambling, and complexity, or what generic means in the process of explaining how to determine whether your system has these properties. So before we begin, there's been a lot of recent work on these as separate. Well, they're sort of, the point of this talk is to tell you how they're related. And so the sort of distinctions I've made are somewhat arbitrary here, and I couldn't even fit works about tensor networks on this slide, which sort of goes under the heading of complexity. But the point is that there's been a lot of work. In particular, a lot of this has been inspired by, as I said, black hole information questions, and more recently by AMPS. And also, I want to give particular attention to the work of Steve Shanker and Douglas Stanford, who really invigorated this recent study of chaos and applying it to these ideas. I'll be telling you about four different papers, sort of distributed nicely among these different categories. And the goal is to tie them together. So, as I said, this begins with trying to understand what we mean by quantum chaos. And so to do that, to understand whether sort of a perturbation grows to have a large effect on the system, we have to understand how operators behave under time evolution. And so to do that, I'm going to start with basically a concrete system, a spin chain. It's about as concrete as you can get, and sort of attack this problem directly and see what we can learn just by brute force, and then by numerics, and then generalize this to other systems. So here I have this sort of Hamiltonian that I'm considering. It's an Ising-like one-dimensional spin chain. There's a nearest neighbor interaction. There's a transverse field. And then there's a parallel field, I guess I should point, Ising, transverse, parallel. And Xi, Yi, Zi are the Pauli spin operators on the ith sites, and I runs from 1 to n. And in the numerics I'm going to show you, at least in this part, n is going to be equal to 8 when I have to choose it. But really, what I'm saying should hold for a large class of Hamiltonians for large values of parameters g and h. And so to begin, as I said, let's just attack this directly. So we want to study the time evolution of the Pauli Z operator on the first site of our spin chain. That's n sites long, n qubits. And so we can just expand this using the Baker-Campbell-Hausdorff formula. And this is what you get. And so I want to draw your attention to two facts. It's a sum of nested commutators with the Hamiltonian. There's k nested commutators for the kth term. And the time dependence goes like t to the k over k factorial. So for early t, as series expansions go, the early terms are important. For late t, the later terms become more and more important. So let's try and understand how these nested commutators are behaving for, say, later terms in this series, or see what the series is doing. So we're just going to compute these directly. We're going to start by taking our Z1 operator, taking the commutator with the Hamiltonian. It doesn't commute because of the transverse field, and so we get Y1. And note, I'm suppressing sort of the G and H dependence. I'm suppressing the dependence of the coefficients. I'm suppressing the time dependence. I just want to understand how what's going to happen to these strings of operators. And so what do I mean by strings? Well, if we do this again, we take y1, which was that was equal to, and commute it with the Hamiltonian. It doesn't commute with any of the terms, so we get an x and a z on the first site, but also we get this xz term because of the nearest neighbor interaction. And so what we see, it grew to be one longer. And if we keep doing this, we're going to notice a pattern that these strings not only proliferate, but they also grow long. And they grow long in sort of a, if you think about how what's happening here, basically, in order for it to not commute with the ZZ term, it needs to not be a Z, so it needs to be flipped by this X term, so it takes basically two terms in the series in order to get a string of additional length. And then once you get strings, and then once it reaches a certain length, you basically proliferate all the different possible strings at that length. And since there are an important point, is since for longer possible string length, there's more possible strings. By strings, I just mean these combinations of X, Y, Z, and I. For later and later terms, this is going to be dominated by longer and longer strings. And of course, if I restored the dependence of G and H and looked at what this term actually is, it's a sum of products of many operators. So we took a simple local operator and we're turning it to a sum of products of operators of high weight.
Question?
Yes.
So at a given order, so there are many, many terms, do all of them grow at a similar, do they appear at the same time, or is there some more structure at a given order?
There? So there is more structure if the system, for instance, is integrable, which right. I can address at the end. In the generic case, there's no discernible structure, and that's going to be sort of part of the point. This is explicit for basically, for particular values, some of these won't appear. But in general, there's no discernible structure. Okay, great. So now that we understand how these strings do grow, the question, it's important to restore the time dependence. And so again, part of this brute force introduction here, we're just going to do sort of the obvious thing. We're going to group our strings by length. And so here, I've isolated the strings of length 2. I'm just assuming there's three of them. In principle, there could be more. And I've labeled their time dependence alpha, beta, gamma. And so I'm going to square them and sum them. And that defines this P2 of T, which is essentially the weight of finding a string of length 2 within this operator decomposition, as part of this operator. The reason to square them is just that this is, if I sum these for all different string lengths, these P of Ks over all K, it's a nice quantity that's conserved under time evolution. So I can do this for, as I was about to say, for all such Ks, and consider and just put this on a computer for, say, 8 spins, and you get the following result. So what you find is that you start, initially it's just a string of length 1. We started with just a simple spin operator on the first site, and then slowly strings of length 1 exchange dominance with strings of length 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, and this spin chain happens to be of length 8 until we get to 8, in which it saturates. And so what this is telling us is sort of what our intuition might have been, that as we wait for larger and larger times, we get the higher and higher order terms in the expansion become more and more important. They're dominated by strings of longer and longer length, and so the strings of the longest length are eventually going to dominate. So this motivates us to try and develop a notion of size of an operator. So how large is our operator? How fast is it growing? These are questions we might want to ask, or we are going to ask. And so to do that, first we can just do the obvious thing. We can just take these weights of length k and some k weighted by these weights, and that gives us the mean, the standard average. But this is not a very nice quantity to consider in other situations. This is something that we developed for our brute force application We could do it for numerics for these simple qubit systems, but in other systems this might not be a very good quantity to consider. So instead we want to consider something perhaps that we could measure, a way of measuring the size of an operator. So that motivates us to develop a second definition. And what I'm going to do is consider a commutator of the operator I'm interested in, z1 of t, with a second simple local operator, which is zj, and j is, so it's just the Pauli Z operator at some site j. And this, so I'm going to take the commutator of these two operators that are separated in space and time, I'm going to square them to avoid phase cancellations, and I'm going to take the minus sign, so that's positive, and then I'm going to average it over the thermal ensemble, which is generally the state I'm interested in. And so what this, my claim is that this object measures the strength of the butterfly effect at site J. It measures the effect of perturbations by ZJ on later measurements of Z1 and vice versa. And so first let's think about what's happening at fixed J. So that means that I have some operator at site J, and then I have Z1 of t, and I'm changing t. So initially, they have support on different places. If this was a relativistic system, we might say that they're space-like separated. But in this case, this is still true for these spin systems. So they commute, and then based on the analysis that we just did, Z1 of t is going to be growing. We know that there are strings that are very long. And when t gets large enough, those terms are going to start to become important. So as we increase time, eventually there's going to be a point when the operator z1 of t is going to grow large enough such that it no longer commutes with zj, and that's what we see here. And then it goes to some late time value. Alternatively, we can study this as a function of fixed t. So now I have some z1 of t, so it's an operator. It has some certain natural radius, and what I'm doing is I'm moving zj around to probe it at different sites and to see when, find the point when it ceases to commute or when it begins to commute again. And this is precisely what we mean by size. We are taking this operator and we're probing our growing operator in a way such that we can figure out how large it is. And we can define the size, for instance, to be the point right when they start to commute again. And in this case, for these spin variables, the maximum is 2, so we can define it as the midpoint when the commutator is equal to 1. And that gives us a nice notion of size for that. That gives us a nice notion of size. So, so this is basically what I just said, written out a little more complicatedly. The size is the J star such that this commutator is equal to 1. 1 is in quotes just because in more general systems, the midpoint might... the midpoint might not be... the midpoint might not be 2, so we basically have to normalize our operator so that it's equal to 1. Okay, great. So now the question becomes, now that we know that we have a way of measuring the size, how fast does our operator grow? And you might think it could be linear, it could be diffusive, and the answer is that it's ballistic. It grows. These operators grow linearly in time. These are the two notions of size that I discussed. This is the nice mean, the brute force one. The staircase is only defined for integers, so it's a relic of studying this system on a lattice, but it follows the other notion of size almost exactly, and we see that it grows until it saturates at the end of the chain, and the growth is linear. So now that we sort of have a brute force understanding of time evolution of operators in these sort of generic systems, the question is how is this relating to the butterfly effect? The butterfly effect is the question of, I have some perturbation at one time, and how does that affect distant operators at some time later? And so, well, I sort of said, my claim is that this commutator is a measure of the butterfly effect. It's a measure of it's a measure of the effect of perturbations V on later measurements of W, or vice versa. And so the claim is that for all simple Hermitian operators, W and V, having order 1 energy and located with some space separation, so x located at x and y, that this commutator should grow. And they have to have order 1 energy because we're interested in making small perturbations. The butterfly effect is I make a small perturbation to the system and I see whether it grows. And then the other operator has to be small for symmetry reasons, or just because you might, if you're going to use it as a probe to measure the other operator, it shouldn't make a large disturbance on the system. And really, this is also intuitively what we mean by the butterfly effect. It is a small operator, a small perturbation growing to have large commutators with every other operator in the system. And so, so this should grow for all such operators, W and V. It's useful to expand this in terms of correlation functions. Correlation functions are a natural object to compute, for instance, in conformal field theory. And so what I've done is just done the algebra and expanded it out. And note that in this talk, the ordering of the operators is not time-ordered. It's the order in which I've written it. And in fact, the operators on both of these lines are not time-ordered. There's two types of terms. There's these red terms, which are like a norm of a perturbed thermal state. So this is like let's consider this one. I have some thermal state. I apply the operator V, and I evolve for a little bit. It's a thermal state, so it thermalizes, and then I apply the operator W, and I'm just taking basically a norm of that state. I expect it to be basically be one at all times, where again this is what one in quotes. I have to divide by these two-point functions. If I had space, I'd do that in all cases, so this would just equal one. These terms on the bottom are different. These terms are like an inner product of two different states. In this one, I apply V first, and then I evolve, and then I apply W, versus the one where I apply W first, and then I evolve first, apply W, and then I evolve backwards and apply V. And for early times, these should also be large. Let's think about, so for instance, if the operators are space-like separated, if we're thinking about a relativistic theory, we can just move these around at will, and of course then these just cancel, and that just tells us, well, what we knew, that outside the causal light cone, the commutator should vanish. But if these red terms are going to stay, basically have a fixed value at late time, and this commutator is expected to grow in the way we studied in the spin chain, then these correlation functions should decay. And so the claim is that they're going to decay sort of exponentially with some delay related to the separation and distance. And so this supports this picture of I make a small perturbation, and then I have to wait some time for that operator to grow and reach. So I make some perturbation W. I have to wait some time for that perturbation to reach the location of where V is. And at that point, the role of chaos is to decorrelate in the sense of this correlation function decaying. And so the claim is that this is the basic diagnostic of quantum chaos, either phrased in terms of these commutators or phrased in terms of these correlation functions. And to sort of get an idea of how this works, what we're going to do is compute these correlation functions in a model setup, in a model system, in one plus one dimensional conformal field theory. And sorry, there's just a bit of terms of notation. Since these are trivial, when people write OTO, or when I write OTO out of time order correlators, I mean this blue ordering here. These also happen to be out of time order, but so I'm just generally referring to these blue ones that have interesting behavior. And since it might be hard to discern, I've tried to make these blue and these red just for at least the remainder of the section where this is relevant. So what I'm interested in doing is computing these correlation functions in one plus one dimensional conformal field theory in two systems. One, a large central charge CFT with a sparse low-lying spectrum, and the other, the two-dimensional Ising model, which is a system known to be integrable. In this sense, we'll see both how chaos, this large CFT is expected to be chaotic, and we'll see how that arises, and the 2D Ising model is known to be integrable. And so we'll be able to compare this diagnostic. So in order to compute this, we have to consider a related quantity, or we will consider a related quantity, which is the Euclidean four-point function on the plane. The Euclidean four-point function is a function of z bar equals z star, but we can also analytically continue it for independent z and z bar. And it's known that all Whiteman functions are analytic continuations of each other. And so considering this as a independent function of z and z bar, for instance, holding z bar fixed and moving, considering this in the complex z plane, there's a branch cut running between the insertion of the v operator at 1 to the insertion of the v operator at infinity. And the difference between the orderings will have to do with the different analytic continuations of this correlation function. The other point I want to make about this is that mapping the cylinder to the plane, we can relate this coordinate z to our Lorentzian coordinates of interest, x and t. And the main takeaway is that the z going to 0 limit corresponds to this late time-like limit that we're interested in, this long time limit. And so since in the interest of time, I'm just going to sketch really quickly how this calculation goes. The important point is that as I mentioned, this correlation function has a branch cut, the continued correlation function has a branch cut running between 1 and infinity, and the continuation procedure is as follows. You take the correlation function with a 0 Lorentzian time, and you give the operators Euclidean time in the order in which you want them to appear in the correlation function. And then you slowly increase the Lorentzian time, and you follow the path of the cross ratio. And for instance, in this ordering, the cross ratio doesn't do anything particularly interesting. And for this ordering, it crosses the branch cut running between 1 and infinity. And so what that tells you is that the chaotic behavior is determined by the second sheet of the continuation of the Euclidean four-point function. So let me just sketch how this works in the two different model systems. So first, for the large central charge CFT, it has a sparse low-lying spectrum, so we can approximate the full correlator using just the Virasoro identity block. And this has all the contributions of all powers and derivatives of the stress tensor. This block was computed by Fitzpatrick, Kaplan, and Walters, and we can just do the continuation. And we see we see behavior consistent with my diagnostic for chaos. So this correlator is equal to 1. This ordering decays exponentially with a delay related to the distance between the operators. There's also this other delay, T star, which is known as the fast scrambling time of Hayden, Preskill, Sacchino, and Susskind. I'll get into scrambling very soon. And sort of confirming our behavior from earlier in the talk, the size of this operator is growing after this delay is growing linearly in time. In 1 plus 1 dimensions, the velocity is 1. In higher dimensions, it's some other number that's not equal to 1, is some other number. And this matches the original computation of this out-of-time order correlator of Shanker and Stanford, who did it holographically originally.
So this
chaotic behavior
always appears
regardless
of this dimension of these operators. I mean,
that
depends on this form of
the conformal
block.
So it depends what you're asking. This behavior that they for this CFT, this behavior that these vanish like this is true for all combinations of operators and dimensions as is the diagnostic. Clearly, though, this rate at which they vanish is depending. HV is the conformal dimension of the V operator. There's another limit you can consider. This limit is sort of a later time limit. There's an earlier time limit you can consider, in which case the rate at which it begins to decay does not depend on the operators, which I can go into to later, but I don't have time to cover right at the moment. Okay. So the other system, the 2D Ising model, this is sort of a sanity check of our prescription. So there's and it's known because it's known to be integrable. So in this case, we can just compute the correlation, the correlators directly. They're known, and there's three different interesting combinations. There's three Virasoro primaries. So there's these three non-trivial operators, and only this 4 sigma operator. I've suppressed the time dependence, but this has the alternating time ordering, and only one of them vanishes at large t. The other are going to 1 or minus 1. So this is consistent with our diagnostic for chaos. Good. So now I'm going to move on to scrambling, and I will tie this back to which I will explain, and then I will tie this back to chaos very soon. So scrambling asks a slightly different question. Can the pure state be, which I've called rho, on AB be distinguished from a maximally mixed state by local measurements on A alone? So I trace out part of my system, and I ask, does that look complete? Is there any information in that state, or does it look completely random? And there's there's a more formal way of talking about this that Don Page considered, and really the only takeaway from this is that local means less than half. So if you have less than half the system, then the criteria for scrambling is that it should basically look maximally mixed. So let's just consider some examples for some intuition for how this works. So here I have a very simple state. It factorizes, it's zero, two qubits, zero on the first one, one on the second one, and I can trace out B and I get a density matrix that's a pure state, which is not maximally mixed. So this system is not scrambled, this state is not scrambled. I can consider A and B in a different state, which is entangled. And I could follow the same procedure. And in this case, I find out that, in fact, this density matrix is maximally mixed just by tracing out B. And so you might conclude that scrambling might have something to do with entanglement. But it can't just be entanglement, because I can consider this setup, which is just two EPR pairs, but considering the subsystems where subsystem A has one EPR pair, subsystem B has the other EPR pair, the state still factorizes. So if I trace out B, I'm left with a pure state, which is not maximally mixed. So it can't just be entanglement. It has to be multipartite entanglement. So here I've considered a more general state with coefficients Cij. And in fact, just for convenience, I'm going to consider a particular state, which is a perfect tensor. This just lets me, this has the nice property that on long any partition, it's maximally entangled. So if I partition the system this way, this is one A and this is B, then I can always arrange the system so that it's entangled across the bipartition, regardless of how I make the bipartition. And in that case, using these properties, one can show that this is maximally mixed. So somehow, multipartite entangled, somehow scrambled states are multipartite entangled. And so the question I want to ask is, what kinds of operators? So everything I said so far is about states. What is the property of states that are scrambled? But the question I want to ask is, what kinds of operators can scramble many states? Page originally showed that generic or hard random operators, so take a random operator and act on any state, and that will lead to that criteria that I mentioned in the beginning for scrambling. Any subsystem less than half will look random, but is this too strong? Does it have to be just sort of a hard random operator that scrambles? And various people have argued that that is too strong, that you can satisfy this notion of scrambling much more simply. And so in order to talk about that, we need to develop a notion of scrambling purely in terms of operators rather than states. And so here's what I mean by that. In order to do that, I'm going to introduce what's called a unitary quantum channel, which is going to be something very familiar, but I think it's a nice perspective by which to consider these concepts of chaos and scrambling. And so here I just have a unitary operator. I can think of it as a tensor, which has input legs and output legs. I've divided these input legs into subsystems A and B, these output legs into subsystems C and D, and this is just a way of writing, this is the way we normally write operators. We can expand it in a basis with these coefficients uij. There's bra ket's I and bra's j, and we do the sum. And there's if this operator acts on a 2 to the n dimensional Hilbert space, then there's 2 to the 2n of these uij coefficients. That suggests that we might be able to map this to a state. And so basically, What I can do is I can map this to a state that lives in a 2 to the 2n dimensional Hilbert space. For functionally, what I've done is I've bent these input legs back down so that they look like output legs, but it's the same divisions of subsystems. In this description here, this ket u what I've done is I basically flipped the bra around to be a ket, and notice that it encodes the same UIJ that we had before. So this encodes the same information that our operator did. I also had to add a normalization because states are normalized, but this is just a mapping from the operator and a convenient way of thinking about this state. If that makes you a little uncomfortable, there's a third perspective, which is I create a bunch of EPR pairs, and then I act on one half of the system with the unitary operator U, and so that picture is basically the same picture of this mapping, and which is related to this unitary operator. So this is maybe a more physical way of thinking of what this bending the input to output legs is doing, but I find that this perspective, I'm going to draw most of my operators looking like this because I find this perspective to be a little more intuitive, but if it makes you uncomfortable, you can just think of this as creating sort of a reference copy of the input, entangling your input with some reference system and then acting with some other unitary operator. So why am I going through this hassle? Before I explain why I'm doing that, you might ask, why do I keep saying channels and not operators? And for the most part, I could just say operators. There's an important distinction, which is that this framework of channels is slightly more general, that it lets me consider ensembles of input. This is something very familiar to a lot of people. It lets me, for instance, the thermal field double state is a channel. It lets me, if I trace out the output legs in this state, which I've written here, what I'm left with is the thermal ensemble. And in general, you can study an arbitrary ensemble. The case here where I'm just flipping this around, I'm studying the properties of this operator with sort of a uniform input. And so why am I going through this hassle? So what I want to do is use this state to compute the entanglement properties of this unitary operator. So if I have a state, this ket U that I made before, I can form a density matrix rho. This is a depiction of what it looks like, so it involves both U and U dagger, not contracted with all dangling indices. And so note that these are input indices, these are output indices, they're all treated on equal footing. And what I can do is I can trace out, for instance, compute the reduced density matrix rho AC, which is going to which is contracted in this manner. And this lets me consider, for instance, the entanglement between the left and the right, so I can compute the entanglement entropy, SAC. I can also compute the Rainey entropy, SAC2, and or I can compute the mutual information between A and C, which is in a sense telling me what happens. So this is why I like this perspective. This is a quantity that's telling me about the information that I put in A, where is it going? Did it end up in subsystem C? So did it end up over here, or IAD would tell me does it end up in D? So this is a way of talking about sort of these quantum circuits, these operators, evolution with these operators, and understanding how the information is propagating in systems under time evolution. And so let's see. So the first thing we're going to do is use this to talk about a way of thinking about scrambling purely in terms of operators rather than states. So just to get some intuition, we're going to start with the identity operator. So that takes A to C, and it takes B to D. So I think of these as, you know, this is some space dimension, and these subsystems are separated in time. So the identity operator just takes A to C and B to D. And note that what this looks like is just a pair of EPR pairs between the input and output. And said another way, the input must be maximally entangled with the output. That lets you know that if you put something into the circuit, it has to end up somewhere on the output of the circuit. The state picture is just where I bend these back over, and that was the picture where we had a collection of EPR pairs, so we sort of knew this. So let's try to figure out where the information. So now I'm imagining that I'm inserting, you know, I'm acting with some operator on A, and I want to figure out what happens to that under this evolution, which is, well, in this case it's trivial. But first, so this tells us that information in A has to end up somewhere in the output system CD, and the reason it's two is that roughly the mutual information is twice the number of EPR pairs shared between the two systems. So between A and CD, there's just one EPR pair, so that's why it's two. It's also two between A and C for the reasons that I just outlined, and there's no information between A and D. So under this evolution, localized information, for instance, localized information in A stayed where it was. It was mapped right to C. So this system obviously does not scramble. There's another type of system that we can consider, the swap operator. So again, just for a system of two qubits and then two output qubits. And so if I put information, this takes the state at A and maps it to D, and B and maps it to C. And so what we find is that, of course, the information in A has to end up somewhere in the output. But in this case, it didn't end up in C, it ended up in D. So I'm still moving information around, but it's staying localized. It's staying localized. So in order to get something interesting, more interesting, we can consider this perfect tensor. This is what the mapping is. The details are not important. What is important, though, is that the state at C depends on both A and B. It depends on both what's going on in A and B, and same thing for the state at D. So this is some more complicated evolution, and using the properties of perfect tensors before, well, first, A, the information in the input has to end up somewhere in the output, as always, but it's not going to be in C or D. Basically, for the reasons that I mentioned before, if I make any bipartition, the perfect tensor has a property that's maximally entangled along that bipartition, and you can quickly convince yourself that the information is no longer localized, so it becomes delocalized. So that motivates a definition for scrambling. So this is just summarizing what we found. And so a natural measure of scrambling is this quantity. So the information ended up in the output, but it did not end up in a particular subsystem of the output. And before we go on, I just want to draw your attention to the fact that this is sort of reminds me of a 2-to-2 scattering, the Feynman diagrams one might draw for a 2-to-2 scattering process. These two are just the non-interacting theory, the diagrams you draw, and then if I have a four-point interaction, I might draw something that looks like this. And so this suggests that if I think of information as being carried by quasi-particles in some capacity, they have to be interacting in order for the system to scramble. Somehow scrambling must be related to that property. So that quantity, in fact, the negative of the quantity on my last slide is the well-known tripartite information. And I've just written in terms of mutual informations and entropies. The reason I3 in the beginning there doesn't have any arguments is that for pure states, so where A, B, C, D is a pure state, it's symmetric between all different arrangements of the arguments. But I've written it in this way to emphasize the analysis that I was doing about where is the information in A going, but it's in fact symmetric. And so the claim is that the negativity of I3 is a natural measure of scrambling. Good. So we study a bunch of simple systems. What's a system what does a typical system do, or a typical channel, or a typical operator? If I consider a typical operator, well, what does that do? And we can use the techniques of Hart integrals. So we can sample U from the Hart ensemble, and we can use that to compute the second Rényi entropy directly. And using a relationship between Rényi entropies and just making, without loss of generality, some assumptions, we can show, for instance, that the mutual information between A and C must be bounded by one bit. And note this doesn't scale with the size of the system. So there could be, for instance, A naturally could have a very large entropy. And so furthermore, we can use this, run through this argument in different combinations, and show that the generic Hart random channels must have near minimum tripartite information. Near minimal there, so it's bounded to be within a bit. And since this naturally has a minimum value that scales with the entropy of the smallest subsystem, this can be very, very close to the minimum. And so the point is that typical channels scramble. And that was something that we should have expected. And so now we can ask sort of the more broader question, what is the property of systems or channels that determines whether, so we're studying operators, so the question is, we're studying operators that scramble many states. And so the question is, what is the property of operators that determines whether finely tuned states are taken to more generic states? And that property obviously is chaos. And so let's tie this back to the things that we were thinking about before. So what we want to do is we want to derive a precise relationship between chaos and scrambling. To do that, we're going to take an average over these out-of-time order correlation functions that we developed in the beginning of the talk. So I'm going to consider an operator in A, separated in time and space from an operator in D. So I'm considering two intervals, A and D, separated in time and space. And what I'm going to do is consider a sum over a complete basis of such operators. So here I've written this sort of schematically, but so consider a basis of operators in D and a complete orthogonal basis of operators in A. This is the out-of-time order correlation function traced over the thermal ensemble, and then this sum ij is an average over all possible operators in DNA, and this is the normalization for the average. There's 4 to the A operators in A, 4 to the A, 4 to the D operators in D. Great. So it turns out that you can evaluate this directly. So it turns out you can evaluate this directly. This is the answer. It tells you that this average over operators in A and operators in D is given by 2 to the n is the number of qubits in your input system or output system. A is the number of qubits in A, D is the number of qubits in D, and this is the second Rayne entropy between A and C. So what this tells you is that the Rayne entropy computed between A and C. The proof is actually pretty simple. It requires, so as a reminder, this is the formula, this is the graphical depiction of rho AC. This is an identity that's true when you do an average over a complete basis surrounding some operator. It's either equal to the identity or traces out that subsystem. You can convince yourself this really easily just by considering, by breaking, say, a simple system into a polyspin basis and just doing it explicitly. And so basically it's just an application of this 3 times. So we apply it to D and we get this picture. We apply it to A and we get this picture. These lines are connected. And this, if you stare at it, is the formula for rho AC squared. When you work out the coefficients, you end up with this relationship.
Question. Can you bring this sum? The dominant part of sum probably comes from certain size of operators. Mm-hmm. Do you know which operators give you
that? Yeah, so that's a good point. So in general, there will be operators of low and high weight for different size region.
Right. But a certain point you're thinking about.
Well, right, so we can consider this, of course, where A and D are small, in which case they're effectively localized. And in fact, I might not have time to go into all the details, but there are perspectives. Both perspectives are useful. But to make contact with the beginning of the talk, we want to take A and D small so that the operators are effectively localized. So what this lets us do, though, is it lets us connect directly the butterfly effect to scrambling. So if we assume that the decay of correlators, if we assume that this average equals some epsilon, then we can bound the tripartite information to be its deviation from the minimum to by this value. So for instance, if epsilon goes to its minimum value, then I3 is exactly at its minimum value. And in particular, what you can show is that in these chaotic systems, that this decay is such that I3 goes to its Haar random value. So these operators go to, sorry, these chaotic systems are driven to the value that a generic system takes. And so in order to get intuitions for how this works, and also there's some nice pictures to look at, we can revisit these numerics. So this is the spin chain I considered earlier in the talk. I've now added in a integrable spin chain with g equals 1 and h equals 0. This is the transverse Ising model. It's related to the 1 plus 1 Ising conformal field theory that we studied, and it's well known to be integrable. And so there's a couple, and I'm studying now this channel where I'm evolving as a function of time. I've divided A, B, C, D into equal subsystems, all of size 3, and again, just directly computing these quantities. So first, we can look at IAC, and we see what's happening under time evolution is that linearly in time, we're getting a decrease in the information between A and C. So what's happening is information you inject in A is slowly growing out into expanding into D. And for the chaotic system, which is this orange line, it stays at this black line, which is the hard random value. So it just linearly decreases until it reaches the hard random value. For the integrable system, we see that it has a recurrence. It starts to grow again. And what's happening, actually, it's more easy to consider this picture. So this is the information between A and D. And so what we see is the chaotic system basically just saturates very near the hard random value, and there's not a lot of information between A and D. But the integrable system, so information is leaking out from AC, from C, between A and C, and then, but it's compensated by increase in information between A and D. And what we see in this nice combination that we've studied and pointed out, so this is the minus the tripartite information normalized by its maximal value. So one is the maximal value. In this case, the hard random value is 0.77. We see the chaotic system is asymptoting to the random value. The integrable system is a much decreased value. And so this is sort of like the swap systems that we were studying earlier. So the system doesn't really have the capacity to create to delocalize information. It can sort of move it around, whereas the chaotic system is scrambling as we sort of motivated. But there's an interesting, I'm just going to wrap up in the final section, where I'll take a couple of minutes, but the final section is just about this fact that very quickly, so if I vary the size of the system, very quickly the chaotic system will head towards the hard random value. Basically, it scales with the size of the system, or the system entropy. So the system, we'd say the system scrambles in time of order s. But is anything happening after that time? That seems like a really short time scale. Is there any natural clock for what's happening in the system after that time? It seems like what this analysis is showing you, that if I just hand you the state, even better than handing you a state, I'm handing you an operator. I'm saying I'm going to apply this operator to any state. Can you tell me basically how long have I been evolving this operator? And what this appears to tell you is that any sort of entanglement that you consider can't tell you how long you've been evolving this operator for. As Lenny Susskind says, entanglement is not enough. So that leads us to computational complexity. And so I'm just going to very quickly introduce what I mean by this, and this is a part of the talk where everything I've said now is I think pretty quantitative and precise, and right now what I'm going to be doing is talk about some more speculative ideas and make a bunch of conjectures. I just wanted to warn you that that's the part of the talk we're in. And so this part is not a conjecture, this part's fine. So right now I can take my time evolution channel and I can discretize it. So this procedure is often called trotterization. Basically, I can divide my Hamiltonian up into two pieces, two mutually commuting pieces, and consider the time evolution, a small amount of time evolution that I would apply between neighboring qubits. And I can think about it like some sort of tensor. If there's some sort of interaction, we can draw it like this, which I've tried to motivate. So here I'm considering the piece of the Hamiltonian between I and I plus 1. I'm taking e to the minus I that Hamiltonian times some delta. Or you can think about this as doing some sort of variational procedure where you try and match these coefficients as closely to the expected time evolution. But the point is that I can discretize my evolution. So I'm going to call this a gate or a tensor in a tensor network. And the important point is that since this involves just, you know, two qubits, the complexity of this is order 1. What that means, the number of gates, the number of operations I have to do in order to build this. And or said another way, I'm measuring my complexity in terms of simple operations like this. And so let's try to understand what happens, what the complexity of time evolution is. So now I'm considering just no time evolution. This is the identity. And so as we've shown the whole talk, this is just a pair of maximally entangled between input and output, or just some straight lines. And then if I want to represent the time evolution with this If I want to discretize a time evolution, I can enact time evolution by applying tensors regularly in this matter. So this is one step, this is two steps, this is three steps, and we see very naturally that this is just growing outwards in this nice pattern. And so it grows. One of the key points is that for the complexity of time evolution grows linearly in time. And that's really by design. I mean, we were just studying, we're discretizing small units of time, and the rate of complexity growth is controlled by the thermal scale. So there's s qubits, and every thermal time I apply basically s gates, and so that's the rate of complexity growth. The thermal scale is the natural scale here because that's sort of the scale at which I expect interactions to happen between neighboring degrees of freedom. And if you ask complexity theorists, a generic state, a hard random state, has exponential complexity, and that's the maximum, the saturated value of complexity. So this begs the question of what is tracking. So we answered the question of what is tracking. What is the difference between two states evolved past their scrambling time s? For different amounts of times, they differ by the amount of complexity they have. We've also established that just by handing that operator, you can't tell me how much complexity it has. So now what I'm going to tell you about is a proposal for how to think about this in holography and tie this back to sort of what motivated me to think of these ideas, which is there some notion in holography that tracks this longer clock, e to the s? And so, said another way, what is the holographic dual of a unitary quantum channel, the objects of our studying that we've been studying? And so this is sort of building on work of Brian Swingle. Hartmann and Maldacena showed that the thermofield double state grows under time evolution, grows linearly with time. Let me explain what grows linearly with time. The length of the thermofield double state grows linearly with time. And so what I've considered here is just some spatial slice anchored at on the left boundary at t equals 0, tl equals 0, anchored on the right boundary at tr equals t. And I can study all the entropies and mutual informations that I studied in the beginning of this talk, and a very simple holographic calculation. It's basically what Hartmann and Maldacena did was that t for times greater than order the Bekenstein-Hawking entropy, the channel has maximal I3, which is minus that value. And these are the RT surfaces that one might consider to compute that. But the key point is that, and so what they proposed is that this in this interior, there's a long flat region which could be thought of as a tensor network. And it's a tensor network for time evolution. So this is, I mentioned this at the beginning, but this is just the thermofield double state is just a unitary quantum channel, and we understand how these behave under time evolution. And so at time of order s, they should scramble, but it appears in the geometry, something in here, if I keep evolving this in time, this, for instance, if I consider space-like surfaces and I evolve in time, they're getting longer and longer, well past order the entropy, and they're going to grow. In fact, in the classical geometry, they're going to grow indefinitely. So the question is, it seems very natural if we're going to associate a tensor network to this, then sort of the length or the volume of this surface is somehow related to its complexity, and the question is what property, what is the geometric property that of the black hole interior that's related to the complexity? What one can do is consider not just an arbitrary space-like slice, but a union of all the different space-like slices anchored at TL equals 0 and TR equals T. And that's this gray region, which I've denoted the Wheeler-DeWitt patch, or which we denote the Wheeler-DeWitt patch. And so that's a nice region that's sensitive to, so this region is sensitive to basically how big the black hole interior is getting. And so what but that that space-time volume has dimensions, and the complexity is dimensionless. So we compute the action on this patch. So we take the classical equations of motion and solve them and evaluate the action on this patch. And so we make the conjecture that that action is equal to the complexity of the field theory state. And so that's a conjecture. We can test this in a bunch of there's a bunch of evidence for this that I really don't have any time to go into. I will just say though that we make a second conjecture, which is that the rate of growth of this action must be less than 2m. So for neutral black holes of all different dimensions and all different sizes, small and big, we find that it exactly saturates 2m. If we add charge, it's less. If we add if we consider rotating black holes, it's less. And so this motivates us to suggest that that this is a bound on complexity growth, and in fact, which lets us interpret black holes, neutral black holes, as being the fastest computers in nature. And this sort of is reasonable because black holes are known to be the strongest, the most chaotic systems, in terms of a precise way that I didn't have time to explain. They're also the densest hard drives, and so chaos is really, as we studied, the capacity to delocalize information. And you need chaos in order to process your information, so it's in a sense the capacity to do computation. And so if you're the most chaotic, then you should probably be the fastest computer. And so this is our conjecture, and that's all I have. Thanks.
Hey. So I have a couple of questions about your last slide.
Yeah.
So when you say neutral black holes are the fastest, are you including rotation?
Right. So rotation actually reduces the action of a rotating black hole. Say BTZ is slowed down by omega J. Where's the So it would be not 2m, but it would be 2m, I think, minus omega j. It's less.
Okay. And in the Schwarzschild case, what do you do with the singularity? Does that contribute to the action, or do you have a boundary term there?
Right. So I just want to add one other thing there. We have some other bounds that we think for instance, rotating and charge. One might be able to make a tighter bound in the cases where there's conserved quantities and argue that black holes saturate that. I just want to focus on the thing that I wrote here, in which case what I said was true, that it's less. Yes, so to compute the action, we consider the York-Gibbons-Hawking boundary terms both at all. So basically, you can throw away the part that's outside the horizon because it's boost invariant, and so it doesn't change in time, and then consider the surface terms on the horizons and on the singularity. So pointing in and there's natural prescription and it makes a contribution. It's important.
Go ahead. So, in your operator, the state mapping, mm-hmm. Does that depend on the basis? Like your choice of basis?
So I think we're considering a natural basis. So we're considering a natural basis. By the way, I'm dividing these up into legs, right?
Okay.
And so I'm keeping that basis. You know, I have input and output legs, and I'm choosing a basis, and then I'm just choosing to interpret them differently. So pick your basis. In the case of interest, normally we consider like the positional basis, because that's you consider mutual informations between regions of space-time, for instance. Or space.
Okay.
Yeah.
I have a question.
Go ahead.
If the system has some conserved quantity, for example, energy, we know that it can diffuse rather than ballistically. So, since all operators go ballistically, do there exist local operators which somehow know about that there is some globally conserved quantity which is not ballistic, but in this out of time,
4.4. Sorry, is your question just how do I...
How would you know that by just looking at out of time operators, that there is correlation function of local operators?
That there's conserved quantities?
That there's some...
Yeah, so actually, this relates to a question of entanglement scrambling in CFT, which I didn't have time to present. This is a quench setup in a CFT, and it's basically the same sort of channel that we're considering. And you might ask about the question of chaos is whether there's a peak in between here and here, whether there's this bump in the information IAD. And so this was studied by Tom Hartman and a bunch of collaborators. And so they write down a criteria that is for to see this. So this peak is associated with the integrable system, and the criteria they identified is that if the system has a number of conserved currents that's greater than this or that's large compared to the central charge, then it's going to have this peak. You can use my machinery, the machinery presented here, to say that those systems that means those systems are integrable. So it shows up in the sense. I could have just answered your question more directly. You'd see that by seeing some sort of peak in IAD, and overall the tripartite information will stay the normalized one will stay small. So that's like having conserved quantities means that the system is less good at delocalizing information. And if you have too many of them, then it's effective. If you have enough of them, then it becomes integrable.
But still, I don't want to get IAD, but just some correlation function of local operator. This is because A and B are not necessarily small, or are they?
In this configuration, they're small.
They're small. Okay. So it's sort of like a. Can I ask one more?
Yeah.
If I make a integrable system and ask about its complexity, how does it look?
Yeah. So my thoughts are that it can never get very large because it has recurrent. Right. Let's think of the swap system, which is clearly integrable, that has tripartite information at zero. Right. And so basically, if I inject an operator, it can only end up, if I inject local information, it has to end up somewhere. So it can basically only get order n, the complexity. Yeah. And so I would say that those systems can't compute there, or they can do classical computation. Go ahead.
So in this computation, you only end up applying a unitary transformation to particular subsystem.
Which computation was part?
This computation I and BC.
You mean the sum over correlation functions?
Yeah.
Okay. I'm applying a unitary to.
So my question is, can you consider a cube gap sum CFT computation? I mean, instead of this and that cubic.
I'm confused about. You're asking about just this averaging. I mean, so this averaging.
Yeah.
I mean, so well, first of all, we can compute in the CFT. We can compute both. I presented a computation of these out of time order correlators, and in certain cases, you can compute the second Rainey. The computation. This computation. This proof just requires a basis of a complete orthogonal basis of operators. So I didn't really assume anything about it being a qubit system.
Further questions? If not, let's thank the speaker.